ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What happens when medicine is sold like a makeover?
Their marketing is very good.
Clinics with five-star reviews selling miracle cures.
I left that place thinking I found myself a solution.
But it's your body that pays the price.
I had one cheek higher than the other, one cheek further out from my nose.
Before and After, a new series on how medical hype spreads online, who profits and who pays. Search for Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jules, you know, in an America that's so divided at the moment,
we've had
this
bit.
Stunning little show bit. Of unity in the House of Representatives and in the Senate of almost a unanimous vote for the release of the Epstein files. 427-1 on the floor of the
Just
House.
Just the one holdout.
Yeah.
Republican, yep.
Bridging the progressive left and the MAGA far, far right.
It's stunning, isn't
it? You said, we've had enough and we want to know the truth.
Yeah. Or we're going to be transparent, or we just want to have a dig around and do our level best to see what's actually in there, because I'm not sure people are going to find what they want there, Jez.
And witnessing all this were victims of Jeffrey Epstein, some of whom were outside the Congress, inside in the gallery viewing the vote.
That's right.
Weeping and shouting thank you to the members who voted for the files to be released.
Reminding us what this is actually meant to be all about. Behind all the politics, all the power plays, all the angry posts on Truth Social, there are some women, there are hundreds and hundreds of women saying our lives have been destroyed almost beyond recognition by what happened to us when we were young.
I'm Jeremy Fernandez in Sydney on Gadigal land.
And I'm Julia Baird, and this is Not Stupid,
where we talk about the news of the week, the stuff that's grabbing our attention, Jules. And another thing I want to talk about this week is the identity crisis that the coalition finds itself in, tearing itself apart federally.
Yep.
And now coming to a point where they agree they're going to abandon net zero. And yet in the States, the Liberals and Nationals trying to build bridges and working out what they stand for when it comes to energy, cost of living, climate.
All right, Jez, let's talk about the Epstein files. I think we should just briefly talk about the history of this. It's become so confusing, like the files coming from where, from what, which direction, who's it being targeted here, why is this something that won't actually go away? Now, Epstein, as we know, notorious character.
He had many famous friends. He managed enormous sums of money
from billionaire
very
himself.
Well-known people.
Yep.
Had private island, private planes, would fly people like, you know, was friends with people like Bill Clinton, Kevin Spacey, and Donald Trump. We know because there are pictures of them there. Donald Trump has spoken favourably about
And Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
That's right, the former prince.
Yes.
The man formerly known as Prince.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump has said in the past, he's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. So there is this lingering question about how much Donald Trump knew about Jeffrey Epstein's activities, even if there is no evidence that he was partaking in them directly.
That's right. I mean, the close friendship, we knew that they partied together. And look, I think it's important to get back to the heart of what this is about. Now, for MAGA, for a large part of the kind of American loosely called right, this has become a very important issue because to them it goes to the question of the deep state, that there's a group of people who are very influential, powerful, elite, connected, who do things and get away with things that other people won't, that somehow they seem to be like, not subject to laws in the same way, definitely not subject to financial penalties, for example, let alone criminal penalties. And so this is something that MAGA has really been touting and talking about for some time. And before the last election, Donald Trump was saying he would release the files.
He was the leader of that movement.
Yep.
He was the one who was promising to undo this secret cabal of perverts who were sexually assaulting women, young women, and now he's found himself on the wrong side of that public sentiment. How has that happened, Jules?
So the files weren't released. And there's been kind of mounting pressure for him to do so. But what we've had is some coming out at some times from different areas. So back in July, these pair that have ultimately formed this successful petition to get these files released, both a Democrat and a Republican, they were bypassing, they're using an unusual part of congressional law because actually Donald Trump could at any moment of every day release these files. And it's completely in his power.
Exactly. And I want to make the point also that the Democrats could have done the same. Joe Biden could have done exactly the same thing. So to see the Democrats so animated about wanting to release the files all of a sudden since Donald Trump has become president also smacks of a bit of kind of weird cover-uppiness, right?
Right. And how's the people who are worried about this in MAGA going to be feeling about all of that?
Yeah.
Just let us see this. So, and Donald Trump has been saying we don't need to. Now, I remember watching an interview before he became president again, and he was being asked, you know, would you release the Kennedy files? Absolutely. Would you release the Epstein files? Yeah, of course. Oh, no, not those. So he's always shown this reluctance. And back in July, this pair sought a House vote for a discharge petition to release the files. And he has said, absolutely not. We don't need it. That's ridiculous. It's all a joke and it's a distraction. It's been defined as a moral issue. But then in September, a US House committee released this first batch and there were more than 13,000 documents in this, files, including information we hadn't seen before, a lot of court files. And there were, look, obviously it was terrible for Mountbatten Windsor, formerly known as Prince. So you might remember that in that release, there was a birthday book of people that had written messages to Epstein, and Donald Trump had a card in there, allegedly, a signature, which appears to have matched his signature. And it was an outline of a woman's body, and his signature was where the pubic hair would be. And he used the words happy birthday and may every day be a wonderful secret. So this idea that there's things that are got up to and, you know.
And that he was part of this secrecy.
Yeah. Just the knowledge of it. The real question here is his knowledge of the abuse. Now, we need to remember that Virginia Giuffre, who was the major accuser, the most prominent accuser, and who said that she'd been trafficked from a young age and had been quite devastating, said that she did not see Trump partake in anything, which has been repeated often by the White House in recent times. So then last week, there was a US congressional committee that released more than 20,000 pages of documents from Epstein. Now, these are the ones that where Epstein says a lot of emails with typos from Epstein, weird kind of collusion with journalists and an obsession with Donald Trump. You can see they fell out. You can see that Epstein was convinced he could bring him down, that he wanted to bring him down, that he was crooked, that he was dirty, I think was the word he used. But he said in that of course Donald Trump knew about the girls. And he said he spent hours with Virginia Giuffre at his house. So that hasn't, shall we say, calmed things down when it's come to the request of the full disclosure.
This is the thing. Donald Trump has been trying to make this a sideshow and say, this is a Democratic hoax. Don't pay any attention to that because grocery prices are going down. I'm solving all these wars overseas.
Yeah.
And the domestic American public is just not buying it. And so it's come to a point where he's had to take action, and instead of authorizing the release of the files on his own through presidential decree, he's asked for it to go through the House.
Well, he's agreed for it to go through. I don't know if it's a request, but that's right. So that's kind of, so the pressure is mounted through all of that. And then we've seen these few days in which he's been under this pressure and he has brought like the head of Kash Patel, the head of the FBI, in to try to pressure two Republican women that have been supporting it. We've seen him attacking Marjorie Taylor Greene, who we'll come back to later, who's been putting pressure on him about it for the purposes of the MAGA base. And then suddenly something happened, Jez. He realised he didn't have the numbers and this was going to happen anyway. So he had to make a U-turn, and this is a very, very unusual thing. There are Republicans that did not fall in line with him, which means a lot of people have fallen upon this and said, oh, there's a sliver here, there's division, there's resistance. But now the whole narrative has changed. Of course we want it out. Of course it's all about the Democrats. Of course the whole thing is still a hoax, but I think you guys should get back to exactly what you were saying, Jez, focusing on what a tremendous job I am doing.
So what can we expect to find out from the files? Because the Justice Department still has the power to redact any information that is currently under investigation. It has the power to redact the identities of people who are identified, particularly victims, people who are identified in these cases that are on foot.
Yeah.
However, it doesn't have the power to redact things that are politically sensitive or potentially embarrassing to people who are mentioned in these files. And then there's also this question of whether there is a list, an incriminating list of Jeffrey Epstein's basically little black book of all his co-conspirators. What do we know about the existence of that list?
Look, what we know about the entirety of these files is that we don't know the entirety. We don't know what's there. They're contained in so many different corners. We know that some of them have already been redacted. Yep. That Trump's name has already been redacted. We know that Trump has said repeatedly about Richard Nixon, hey, what an idiot to leave those tapes around. We know, like, so if I was someone who was really intent on getting to the truth of this, because I've been bombarded with a blizzard of documents, I don't think I would be particularly comfortable that everything would be in train. There's going to be other documents. There's state cases which are being held on the question of Epstein. There's most of it, you know, we think is coming from the FBI. But I think we could be going on for years with people trying to get full access to the Epstein documents, which kind of leaves us in a very difficult position, I think.
Can I talk about another thing that really fascinated me this week?
Yeah.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, yeah, or Marjorie Traitor Greene, as Donald Trump is now calling
her. Oh, no, he was calling her Marjorie Traitor Brown.
Right.
Because he said when things begin to rot, they go brown. And I think one of the late night hosts was like, mate, if you need to spell out why you what your nickname insults is for someone, yeah, it's probably not a very good one, but yes.
So she was one of Donald Trump's greatest MAGA backers,
yep,
famously anti-abortion, anti-immigration, pro-wall, anti-American involvement in foreign,
yep,
policy,
mm-hmm,
and just really focusing domestically, and has since stepped out and said she wanted the Epstein files released and that Donald Trump's conduct is not befitting of a president.
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary to step out like
and
that
of course
and put yourself in his firing line.
He just took that on the chin. He said, fair cop, people have got different views, didn't he, Jez?
In a parallel universe,
he called her a traitor. Yeah. He really attacked her savagely, again, on Truth Social. Another point here, by the way, when we're talking about Trump on Truth Social, he doesn't really use email, Trump, so there's not as much of an easy trail as there would be that someone might think with people like Epstein. But no, he savaged her, and then she came out and said she was wounded by that because she's not a traitor, she's standing with the women.
He's called her a wacky woman, a ranting lunatic, a traitor, a disgrace. She says for her part, the American people deserve full transparency into who was involved in these horrific acts.
Mm.
And so in characterising her as a traitor, she's kind of said, well, she's the one standing with the people, victims of sexual abuse here.
Mm. There are some people saying that she's going to be making a bid for the presidency and she's just cutting her losses and just fully going
so read
for
the
it.
Room, read, basically.
Yeah, but what is reading the room here? Here's the thing. Like, this is probably a clever way of saying, here's a bunch of info. There's going to be a lot of people mentioned in here, and there's going to be a lot of people really sweating bullets right now, by the way. I mean, Larry Summers, a former head of Harvard, has now stepped back from a lot of his duties. He's still an op-ed writer for the New York Times, and I think he still teaches at Harvard. But people like Elizabeth Warren have wrote and said, mate, when you have that proximity to someone like Epstein after he's had the charges of sexual abuse or trafficking that he had in Florida, then you can't have a position like the one you do now. And it was awkward. The correspondence between Larry Summers and Epstein was advising him on how to handle women. And some are saying things like, oh, I want, there's a woman I'm interested in, but I don't really want to compete with gift giving with her and being a friend without benefits and so on. So a lot of people caught in this net, a lot of scrutiny about whether Clinton's going to appear in here. So Kevin Rudd, by the way, has been mentioned in this as a, as being at some event, and he's absolutely categorically denied it. So that's the other thing, is there's going to have to be a round of fact-checking for this stuff as well. And we do know that Epstein was a very manipulative man who was intent on trying to destroy Donald Trump. Like he really repeatedly said that.
And clearly kept receipts to some degree as well, right?
Kept receipts, and which is why when he was found to have killed himself, a lot of people were really suspicious about it, you know, because it was known for that, that he had this, not just a alleged black book, but a great visceral animosity towards Donald Trump.
So, Jules, as we're recording this, the US president has yet to ratify this bill that's passed through Congress. We expect that will happen. There's no sense that Donald Trump will change his mind. How much do you expect that will quell the curiosity around what happened and people's desire to get to the bottom of who was involved and how significant the cover-up has been?
I do think that he had no other option but to do this and to at least make a show of transparency by sheer volume. I think that what's happened recently is that his popularity, like his approval ratings, are flirting with kind of going below 40. A lot of the things recently that have happened, as well as the economy and healthcare, he's taken a few hits that have shaved off bit by bit, and it's now actually starting to hurt. And so there are more whisperings around MAGA. There are people coming to the Capitol, MAGA influencers, who are saying, well, actually, I'm really worried about corruption here. You know, some people are going increasingly wild, like Megyn Kelly, the former Fox contributor who has her own podcast, who was saying the other night, well, you know, these girls weren't 8. I mean, you know, they were 15. I was really shocked by her saying that. She said on her YouTube show he was into the barely legal type, like he liked 15-year-old girls, and I realise this is disgusting. I'm definitely not trying to make an excuse for this. I'm just giving you the fact that he wasn't into, like, 8-year-old girls. Doubled down the next day. He said, look, we've yet to see anyone come forward and say, I was under 10, I was under 14. There's a difference between a 15-year-old and a 5-year-old.
As if to excuse it. What is
going on there? Because, and I think what's interesting is that the MAGA faithful haven't cared about indictments, haven't cared about criminal convictions, haven't cared about sexual abuse against women. I've always regarded him as a flawed man who's going to blow up the system and all the rest of it. But this has always been a line. And that's why it's been so important that he address it. People peeling off like Marjorie Taylor Greene is significant. I feel like some people are going to leap on this as a sign of cracks, and could this be the beginning of the end? But history to date has shown us that he's very skillful at motoring over any suggestion of impropriety.
So, Jules, domestically, it's been a pretty dramatic couple of weeks in politics here, particularly for the coalition, which has, since we last spoke, abandoned its net zero policy, its net zero target.
What did you think of that?
I thought, look, it really speaks to the result from the last election, right? Because the Liberals are the coalition partner that did worse in the election. The Nationals actually pretty much held their ground at the last election. And so they now form a greater proportion of the coalition. Mm-hmm. And you can see that coming forth because no one in the city asked for a rethink on net zero. This is a very kind of distinct Nationals policy. And now that they have more power and a greater proportion of the coalition, it's become coalition policy. And so what we've seen is the coalition having to decide, do we listen to voters in the cities who don't have a problem with net zero overwhelmingly, or do we go with the Nationals and their thinking from their mostly regional seats where net zero is regarded as a problem and needs to be removed? I think it's a really difficult position that Susan Lee is in to try to build a bridge between those two sentiments, because at some point they've got to meet in the middle of two extremes.
Right. And yet, Like, isn't the point of leadership, a lot of people talking about the need for a broad church and that Howard, John Howard had a broad church when he was prime minister and leader. And I think that's important not to let go of. Like, there must be a position in which people can cohabit in the same party and have different views on net zero. I find it very reductive in a lot of ways. Like, so we're just, we used to always just talk about the carbon tax. That was just it. The only way we spoke about climate. Like, why is there no capacity for rhetoric that can unite us and kind of move us forward and take away some of the culture war stuff of climate?
Susan Lee's sort of attempting to do that by saying the coalition is going to take a technology agnostic approach. That is not to say we love clean energy, we love coal. It's just to say we just want to bring energy.
Is it agnostic
down, though?
But
this is the point, right? This is how they're defining it.
Yeah.
That it's going to be technology agnostic, so we just want to bring power prices down and turn this into a cost of living issue.
Yeah, but we also want to use government money to prop up coal stations.
So this is the interesting development as well. This sort of quite separately, but alongside this, South Korea has just announced
that
is going to move towards net zero.
This is the way the world is going.
South Korea accounts for 8% of the world's thermal coal consumption, one of the biggest importers of Australian thermal coal.
I think our third biggest, couple of
and
billion.
And now they've said, we're out.
Yeah.
So where does this leave the coalition? Where does it leave the National Party? And I want to talk about where this leaves the individual states, because you've got the state leadership in New South Wales and Victoria, where the Nationals and Liberals are trying to build bridges and trying to work out where they stand on this whole net zero thing, right? There's a recognition in Victoria and New South Wales that voters don't really have the appetite for abandoning net zero. You've got the Nationals in New South Wales. They've got a new leader. Mm-hmm. Their leader left. They've now got a new member from Coffs Harbour.
Yep.
You've got Mark Speakman, the Liberal leader in New South Wales, who hasn't been polling all that well. His leadership is under threat. He could be very well replaced in the next few days and weeks
by
a younger woman.
Yes.
Kelly Sloan, former journalist, member for Vaucluse. Now, in Victoria this week, they have replaced, for the third time in 11 months, their Liberal leader. It's Jess Wilson, the first Liberal female leader in Victoria.
Yep.
And she's a millennial. And she represents
35, right?
Generational change in a way that the federal coalition is almost being quite regressive and going back to its previous position on not supporting things like net zero, being agnostic on climate.
Yeah, just kind of not brawling about it. Yes, we need to do something about it. Yes, we need to consult broadly. I think it's really interesting with Jess Wilson because she is widely respected as talented, and she, for the first time in many years, both factions came in behind her in Victoria. And there's been brawling and dysfunction there for so long in the Liberal Party that was quite interesting to observe, I think. And that puts her in really good stead, not just to drive the state, but to drive the conversation nationally about what needs to be done.
And because, too, the Labor government in Victoria has a few problems, like debt has been going up. And yes, there is an argument that Victoria's public assets have also increased in value. So debt is not quite as bad as some sectors of the media make it out to be, but debt has objectively been going up in Victoria. Crime has been on the rise. The coalition has less and less been attractive to people under 50. Yeah. They do particularly poorly among the voting cohort between 18 and 24 years old. The coalition is not popular in Victoria among people from diverse communities, many of whom live in battleground seats.
Yep.
So she is seen as this generational change. For a start, she doesn't look like any of the previous leaders, right? And so she represents this change, and I think it's a really interesting thing because whatever the states decide to do, whatever New South Wales and Victoria decide to do in the coalition, whether they decide to build a bridge or follow their federal counterparts and go backwards.
And let's not forget what the vote was in the last election for people of that age group.
Yeah.
You know, from like 18 to 35 or so, it was very strongly not the coalition.
So whatever they decide in the states is going to be consequential for how the federal party, the federal coalition responds and again, to use a term again, reads the room about what it is that voters want.
Yeah, and just I think the question of being distracted by all this other stuff. It really affects their ability to get across the core message and tell us a story.
Not only that, it's destabilizing for business. One of the core things that business and the economy need is stability. Like, decide on whatever policy, but just stand by it, because chopping and changing is actually really damaging.
Yep, terrible
business
investment
confidence, and to attract investment.
Yeah. And you do wonder, is it within Susan Lee's capability to speak to the whole party? Well, the opposition coming from rural areas isn't because people friggin' hate trees, right? Because they feel like things are being imposed on them from cities without sufficient consultation.
And like, farmers do, like, there are a lot of farmers who do a really terrific job with environmental management.
Exactly.
Right? It has to be said, the way they kind of manage farming practices on land and making sure that it's, you know, in some way, I mean, it's not perfect, but environmentally at least, much more mindful than it used to be.
Yeah, Farmers Federation have been urging the government to do more about this for quite a long time. So part of this is about being in and understanding your communities and making them feel like they're heard, right? But I thought what was really good was a piece by Jane Bunkle. She is a Liberal in New South Wales and a barrister. And she wrote a piece about saying these are the things that the Liberal government needs to do. And I thought it just laid it out very succinctly. It was an op-ed in the Nine newspapers. She said the party has to seek to govern for the economy we are moving into rather than pining for one that no longer exists. She says the debate shouldn't be a zero-sum game between energy affordability and net zero. Reducing power bills matters enormously to households and businesses, and Australians are right to demand scrutiny about this, but it's misleading to suggest net zero is driving up prices. The real pressures come from aging coal plants, global fuel volatility, and deferred investment, exactly what you were just talking about. So she says, like, the only durable pathway to lower prices is making a transition, because then we're less exposed to volatile fossil fuel markets, we can rely on domestic energy, and so on. Second, the party has to embrace the opportunities inherent in the transition: technology, advanced manufacturing, industry that's energy intensive. And third, the party must respect women's autonomy and equality. Like, it's shouldn't be that hard. Think about a modern workplace.
Do you know what this strikes me as, though? Right. This is like almost exactly the Teal platform, right? This is exactly what the Teals are.
It's also a Liberal moderate platform, and that's where the clash is.
Yeah.
Right? Fourth, the party must champion our institutions, courts, universities, public service, and scientific agencies are not enemies to be subdued, but pillars of a democratic society governed by law. And then when a party drifts into performative hostility towards its own institutions, it trades governing credibility for short-term applause. Fifth, the party must affirmatively welcome migration, which has built Australia's prosperity. If the party signals ambivalence or hostility towards migrants, it fractures its coalition of voters and invites a new centre-right alternative to fill the vacuum. And she says, finally, kind of thought this was interesting, the party has to resist the lure of culture war populism. Modern conservatism is steady. It's not reactionary. It's prudent, not paranoid, unifying, not exclusionary. A party consumed by culture wars loses the ability to speak to the mainstream and becomes captive to its angriest voices. What do you reckon?
I feel like there were so many memes going around this week about how the Teals have now got a job for life because the coalition is tearing itself apart over this issue, which in some ways and to some sectors of the community would be just, this is so obvious, this is really not that complicated. Having said that, I wonder what appetite there is for this in the National Party, which occupies now a greater proportion of the coalition, and whether they would find this all a bit unpalatable.
There's a reason that former leaders of the Nationals and the Liberal Party, you know, Prime Ministers like John Howard, were coming out when they threatened to split previously. Guys, they've managed much bigger rifts than this in the past. Mm. It's almost like a reflection of our culture now, where everyone has to agree on absolutely everything. No. Mm. But do you want a seat at the table or not? I guess that's the question for the Nationals. The question for the Liberals, or both of them, is do you want to have any crack at government or not? Are you going to, in a Menzian sense, be representative and reflect the electorate?
And also just perform the job of opposition, right? What we need in any system such as ours is for an opposition that holds the government to account.
Yeah.
And right now, while they're fighting amongst themselves, they're not really meeting those challenges,
it's a
that
terrible
task of holding the Labor government to account.
Yeah. There's, you know, plenty of heated conversations going on behind the scenes, we know. But I think, as you've pointed out, having New South Wales and Victoria seemingly moving more to the centre now, that's going to be fascinating. Will these be the states that will, you know, nudge the Liberal Party more towards a moderate centre, or will this lead to a greater fracturing? And it's ultimately, I think, about kind of the will of the party, medium to long-term thinking and leadership. Jez, time for Pick of the Week.
Yay.
Yay.
I've got a good one for you this week.
Okay, good.
All right. So I came across this post on Threads by a man named Scott Clary. He's an entrepreneurship mindset wealth coach. He's got his own podcast. And he posted this piece of advice. Major cheat code in life. Show up when it doesn't benefit you. The funeral of someone you barely knew. The move you don't want to help with. The celebration that's inconvenient. That's where character lives.
True.
Anyone can show up when it's easy.
Yep.
Character shows up when it's not. Be someone people can count on, especially when you don't have to be. And I thought it was a really interesting sentiment, this idea that, you know, sometimes there's sort of performative acts of service.
Yep.
And sometimes you do it and you expect no applause and you get no applause and someone else gets the credit.
Yep. And sometimes even the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually difficult to do and it's unpleasant to do, but you've done the right thing.
100%. So this popped up in my feed on the very same day I came across this other post, completely unrelated. It was a caller named Meg who called ABC Radio Perth on a talkback kind of show. She was talking to Nadia Matsopoulos, who's the host of ABC Radio Breakfast in Perth. And Meg relays this story about a friend of a friend who's a retiree. This friend had read the paper and saw that her old boyfriend had died. His name was Jim Snooks or something like that. So this friend went to the funeral, signed the guest book, and then partway through realised she didn't recognise anyone there and realised she was at the wrong Jim Snooks funeral.
And the one she knew was still alive.
Presumably so. But decided to stay for the whole service. But this was not the man that she had formerly dated. She stayed for the service, quietly slinked out afterwards. A week later, she gets a call from a lawyer who asks her, "Were you at Jim Snooks' funeral the other day?" And she starts to own up. She says, I'm really sorry. It was actually the wrong person. I thought I knew him, but I didn't. But yes, I was there. And the lawyer says, well, no need to apologise. He's left $2,000 for every person who attended his funeral.
Oh, that's so good.
And this woman was...
Was it a well-attended funeral?
At the time.
Oh,
and
Jim Snooks,
got a daughter
who
lives in Sydney, so she decided to spend the money flying from Perth to Sydney to see her daughter. Money well spent for an act of service that wasn't quite intended, but it all worked out great in the end. So, like, you know, show up for a funeral for somebody you don't know, you know. Isn't that a coincidence? So I came
that
across those two things and I went, that's so true. Yes. Be the person who, you know, shows
up. She turns up. She showed up.
She did show up.
I feel like the universe was saying to you, yes. Yeah. It might not be financial profit, but you too will prosper if you do the right thing. I know I'm often noticing on social media, like all the wellness stuff, great. But no one ever goes, you know what, you're feeling really shitty, you're this, that, and the other. Go and do something for someone that's going to be really boring or annoying, or you might have to get up early, or you might have to do whatever. And, you know, you'll feel better at the end of the day because you've helped someone else. Like, it just, it's such a fundamental thing that we were made to care for each other.
Yeah. I find it takes me out of my own head if I do something like that. And sometimes that even the smallest expression of thanks just lifts me up immeasurably.
Totally.
Just the idea that I could be useful to someone.
Yeah.
can yes. be a really lovely thing.
Yeah. yeah.
Okay, your turn. Pick of the week. Okay. What have you got?
Gosh, well, I want to really quickly mention Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at Sydney Theatre Company. Excellent production.
Oh, great.
Okay. Directed by Sarah Goods. Cat Stewart is phenomenal as Martha. I've always loved that play. It's just one of my favourites, and it's just so crisp with contempt and yearning and a sodden night gone very kind of wrong. It's a really good iteration. I liked it a lot. I also was almost going to talk about a robot vacuum that went astray. Did you hear about this?
I really want one.
You do want one?
I really do want one, but I'm a bit scared of
well,
for exactly what I think I'm about to
mention. Close your front door because this one escaped. It was owned by a snake catcher in Queensland, and it just made it out the front door. And they got this security camera footage of it, like having bid for freedom, up the driveway, onto the road. But then it was also maybe a cautionary tale for rogue vacuums because it got run over.
Oh yeah. That can be quite dangerous,
yeah.
I suspect.
So, you know.
Explosion and all that.
They had to retrieve it. They were very bemused as to why it went so viral. I could feel like people really project onto these things like go little vacuum.
Well, it's
run for your life.
It's the one piece of technology that isn't taking away from the joy of what we do, the writing, the art.
Yeah.
It is doing the vacuuming, which is what AI and robots were meant to do in the first place.
Yeah, but will they stick around when they get bored? They might just leave.
And leave and write poetry.
Yeah. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is celebrity traitors. I've been doing the hard yards in front of the television chairs. Have you heard of it?
I don't know a lot about it.
It's around. So it's out of the UK. Mm-hmm. And it's been this big sensation there. And it's got a lot of younger people watching television getting really hooked on it.
So it's a reality TV show.
Reality TV. You get a bunch of people. They go into a house, like a mansion. It's very beautiful. And there's like three of them that are nominated traitors, but no one else knows about it.
Oh, I like this already.
Yeah. And then the others, called the Faithfuls, have to try to work it out.
Oh, and this is a bit like Cluedo, but in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, but every night the traitors will murder someone, not in front of everyone else, but they'll get murdered and then they'll have the breakfast table and someone is not there. And they're like, wait, and they're trying to work out the strategy the whole time.
These are all my favourite games from when I was a kid.
But really great. So it's like Stephen Fry's in it.
Oh, right.
And he's adorable because he kind of keeps going, well, I just can't work it out. He just couldn't figure it out. And everyone's like, but you're so intelligent. And he just couldn't work it out. Joe Wilson, you know, the comedian, Nick Muhammad, who is from Ted Lasso, mm-hmm. who befriends Joe Marler, who's a big former rugby player, like massive man. And Nick is very small. The friendships that these guys form between themselves is really great. And honestly, like, I won't give anything away, but for the first few, they just get it wrong because they have to vote someone out every day as well. They get it wrong time after time again.
So the traitors are doing a good job of hiding
their identities.
They
cannot work it out.
Right.
They can't work it out. And then at the very end, in the very last episode, there's a massive twist. And it's just such a great way of like watching people pretend to be something that they're not. And like convincing a whole bunch of other people, another really artless people saying, I'm telling you, I'm not a traitor, I'm a faithful, and not being believed.
This is real life.
It's real life. I know, but it's really fun. I would highly recommend that. Yeah.
Oh, good. Thank you. Jules, very nice to catch up. I've missed you. It's been a couple of weeks. I had some family stuff to deal with last week and fun stuff to take care of and work things, but I'm back.
Now I've got you back. And apologies to those who are listening to this on audio, but can I point out the dashing jacket you found in an op shop, which you're currently sporting?
You've inspired me. You and my daughter have inspired me to go op shopping again for the first time in many years. And I've picked up this beautiful leather jacket for not very much money, and I love it.
Yeah, and it's a very fancy brand.
All hail the op shops. So.
Exactly. Yeah. It's because unlike shopping with other things, you get the serendipity of like, oh, I just landed on this thing out of the blue and it's a bargain.
And the virtuousness that goes with it. I've upcycled something.
You're smug now. Smug and looking fine. It's a great combination. Okay, our producers are Madeline Jenner and Cinema Nippard.
Jules, great to catch up.
And if you want to contact us,
notstupid@abc.net.au.